Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. The number of Americans without health insurance now tops 45 million, and as health care costs and premiums continue to grow, there is every reason to believe that the uninsured population will grow as well. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about why the insurance gap continues to widen, what it means for the health of those people who do not have insurance, and also what it means for those who do. And our guest for the program is Catherine Baker. She is a professor of health economics and the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. She is also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Let me tell you just a little bit more about her. Between 2005 and 2007, she served as a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, where she played a leading role in the development of health policy. She currently serves on the editorial board of Health Affairs as a commissioner on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Commission to Build a Healthier America and on the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Health Insurance Status and Its Consequences. And this morning, a lot of what we'll have to say comes, in fact, from a report issued by that committee that came out just a couple of months ago, looking at the consequences for health and health care of America's uninsured crisis. And as we talk, certainly questions, comments are welcome. If you want to be a part of our conversation, that's really easy for you to do. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's 800-222-9455. Anyone's welcome to call with a question or a comment. We just ask callers to keep their questions, comments brief so we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. But questions are certainly welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Baker, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. One, just before getting into talking about some of the specifics here, and I think what I'd like to try to do is get an overview of the basic issues that are in the report, and those are the ones that I tried to point to. That is, you know, what do the numbers look like? What are the trends? What's it mean for the people who don't have insurance? And then you have to ask the larger question about, well, what does it mean for even people who do have insurance. But before doing that, one thing I want to note here, and it's something that the report addresses, is that the Institute of Medicine, the organization here, Institute of the National Academies, that issued the report that here we're talking about, between 2001 and 2004, the Institute issued six reports looking essentially at some of these same kinds of issues. And I think in part the fact that we have another one now stems from, I'm sure, some level of frustration, perhaps, in addition to the need for current data, but some level of frustration with people like you and other people who are concerned about this issue, who say, look, we keep issuing reports and nothing happens. We, as a nation, this is something that we still have failed to address.
Absolutely. And I think one of the frustrations of policymakers is that the research community can't come out with definitive answers to a lot of the questions that we care about, but the suggestive evidence is so strong that it seems irresponsible to wait to act until we have the perfect evidence. And the report tries to go through all of the evidence that we do have and concludes that there's overwhelming evidence that being uninsured is not good for your health and, in fact, has adverse consequences on other people living in your community as well. And this suggests that we really do need to address the problem now, even as we go forward trying to get even better evidence. Mm.
Well, that, you know, that surprises me. I guess I can appreciate the fact that people who work on policy sometimes are interested in very fine distinctions and want to get things nailed down to a very high degree. And at the same time, though, you, as sort of a layperson, I think, well, truly, what is it that you still need to know? I mean, don't we really basically have some pretty good answers to these questions like, well, what does it mean not to have insurance and how many people don't? And, you know, what happens if we keep going the way we're going? What is it that we don't know?
Well, there are lots of questions that we could use more specific answers to. What are the mechanisms through which getting access to health care really affects your health? What are the trade-offs between preventive care and use of emergency services or hospitalizations? Answering these questions in a more refined way could help us develop even more refined policies that would improve people's health, getting the most bang for the buck out of public dollars. Mm-hmm. But because we don't have those very refined answers, is no excuse not to do the best that we can with the evidence that we have on hand. And that's the real message of the report, is that the evidence that being uninsured is bad for your health is very strong. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that clashes with anyone's perception of the way getting health care works in the world. If you don't have access to insurance, you surely have reduced access to important preventive care, to diagnosis of diseases early when they can still be managed, to high quality and continuous care rather than fragmented care that you get in lots of different settings where providers can't communicate with each other about your care.
Well, let's talk about the big number. At this point, how many people here in the United States do not have health insurance?
It's around 46 million or so. It's you read slightly different numbers from different surveys at different points in time. And that also highlights the fact that uninsurance is a very dynamic state of affairs for most people. If you look at the number of people who are insured at any given point in time, it's a lot more than the number of people who are uninsured for a whole year, because people move in and out of having insurance depending on their work situation, depending on their eligibility for public programs as their income changes. And that can lead to fragmentation of care, even for people who at the moment have insurance.
Yeah, and that's a reflection of how people end up getting their care. And a lot of that is, as you say, the fact that for a lot of people, the way they get their health care is through their job.
Yes, and that's a problem for people who don't have access to health insurance through their job. They're left to a non-group market that does not function particularly well. And it's a problem even for people who do have insurance through their jobs, because they're at risk of losing their insurance if they should lose their job or want to retire early.
And we should also, I guess, make the point that this number that we're talking about, this close to 46 million individuals who do not have health insurance, that if we look back a couple of years, we can see, you plot that out on a graph, that line keeps going up. That is the trend in the number is trending up.
Yes, and that is despite expansions of public health insurance programs that target particular subpopulations like low-income children. It's important to note that group of uninsured people is very different along lots of important dimensions that suggest different policies we might want to think about to address covering them. The majority of those uninsured people actually have a job or in a household where at least one person has a full-time job. So it's not just the unemployed. A lot of them are in households with income above the poverty line. So it's not just the very poor, it's the near poor as well, or even middle-income people. The educational background, the racial and ethnic backgrounds are really widely varied across that population. It's not just a group of very low-income, unemployed people who fall into the gaps of our insurance system.
Well, is there some way to say to pair out of there, let us say, people who are working and people who would have access to some kind of health insurance, but simply it's just the premiums are just too expensive. What they would have to pay, their out-of-pocket costs would be so much that they just have to say, well, I just can't do it because I just can't afford it.
Yeah, that's a really important question, is what share of the uninsured would face premiums that are unaffordable for them? And that's a product both of what your income is and of the premium that you face. So the people for whom it would be unaffordable are both low-income people and people who might not be so low-income but face very high premiums, especially if they're looking for insurance in the non-group market and they have an existing health condition. They are facing premiums that depend on that health condition and thus may be unaffordable for them. Very few low-income uninsured people have turned down employer insurance. Most of them, in fact, either weren't offered employer insurance or are not employed.
Mm-hmm. And one more question here. We've seen this number, the number of individuals without health insurance trending up. Is it, it seems, and I think I already know the answer to the question, but do we have reason to expect that in at least over the next few years that that number should continue to get bigger?
I think we're at great risk of that number increasing, especially in light of the economic downturn, with so many people getting their insurance through their jobs. When there are job separations, those people are at particular risk of uninsurance, especially older populations or sicker populations who were being subsidized by their healthier or younger coworkers in their jobs and then won't have that subsidy when they go to the individual non-group market.
Just to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in last few minutes, we're talking with Catherine Baker. She's professor of health economics in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. She is also a member of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Health Insurance Status and Its Consequences. And this was the committee that was responsible for this report that we're here talking about on the crisis of the uninsured in the country. It came out a little earlier this year, a couple of months ago. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I suppose in a way that you have in part answered the question that I'm about to ask, but let me just go ahead and ask it anyway. As you've just said, that there's good reason to think that the number of people without insurance is going to continue to trend up. What are the factors that have contributed to the not only that we have a significant number of people who don't have insurance, but that that number continues to grow?
It's in part the general economic trends. When you see a downturn in employment, those people who lose their jobs are at risk of uninsurance, as we were just talking about. But it's also a change in the types of jobs that people have. If there's a movement from sectors that traditionally offer health insurance to sectors that traditionally don't offer health insurance, even if employment stays the same, the workers who move over may lose their insurance status or lose their insurance. Also movement from full-time work with benefits to part-time work without benefits. Both of those may be driven by rising health care costs. The thing that drives health insurance premiums up is, by and large, increases in average health care spending in insured populations. So as health care costs rise and premiums rise, small employers in particular are likely to drop health insurance offerings. Individuals are less likely to be able to afford the premiums that they face in the non-group market or their copays through their employer. And firms are more likely to move workers from full-time jobs with benefits to part-time jobs without benefits, especially low-wage workers whose wages can't adjust downward because of, for example, minimum wages or other rigidities in labor markets.
Yeah. I'm just looking at here, and I have a couple calls I want to get to, but I'm just looking here at two maps of the United States that are here as part of this report that really it's very dramatic if you take a look at it, where you go state by state and they show the percentage of adults who are not insured in those states. Mm-hmm. And if we go back to the period 99 to 2000, there were only two states where essentially like a quarter or more of the people were uninsured, and that was New Mexico and Texas. And then if you go to this more recent period, the 2006-2007, suddenly those areas of the country where you got 23% or more uninsured, it jumps to, now it's California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Florida. And the number of states where they were doing the best, where fewer than 14% were uninsured, has shrunk from, it looks like there were like about maybe 8 or 10, now down to 4 or 5, or, well, maybe 6. So it's just, if you look at it that way, you know, the percentages, there's been this big jump in the percentages of uninsured, and it seems like it's in certain parts of the country, particularly in the Southwest, South and Southwest, it's been very dramatic.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, Hispanic populations are at much greater risk of being uninsured than different racial and ethnic groups. And those state-level statistics mask a lot of variation even within states. If you look at a high uninsurance state, there'll be communities where there's rampant uninsurance and then communities where uninsurance rates are very low. So even within states, people face very different access to health care.
Yeah. We have some callers here. Why don't we talk with them, starting with someone in Champaign. This is our line number one. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
I've been studying this problem for quite some time and have become convinced that the only way we're ever going to achieve true universal coverage is if we accomplish two basic things. One is we have a single group that includes the entire population, doesn't make distinctions whether you're, you know, regardless of your age or health, or pre-existing conditions, that sort of thing. And two, that we do as virtually all other industrialized nations have done, and remove the profit motive from health insurance. You know, as long as we have these private insurance companies that have really huge overhead and you know, are trying to make big profits for their CEOs, executives, and their shareholders, we're not going to have either universal coverage or even affordable coverage.
Well, Professor Baker, can you want to comment on that?
Yes. Let me start by saying that the Institute of Medicine report you were speaking to really addresses the effect of being uninsured on health care and health outcomes without outlining any proposals for health reform. So, you know, let me separate my comments from that Institute of Medicine report, and then let me address the caller's comments wearing the hat of Catherine Baker, which the idea that a single system is going to deliver high-value care isn't as clear to me as it seemed to be to the caller. If you look at the Medicare system, it took Medicare 40 years to introduce a prescription drug benefit, long after private health insurers had, because the system was very slow to adapt to the modern medical world. When Medicare was first introduced in 1965, prescription drugs were not an important part of health care, and they weren't expensive enough to warrant inclusion, and that is clearly not the case today. There's a happy medium, I think, between the efficiencies of having less underwriting by insurers and coordinated billing and the like, and the innovation that seems to be driven by insurers competing to cover people in the highest value way possible. And what I would love to do is develop a reform that maintains that incentive for innovative frontier medicine and insurance design while ensuring that the benefits are spread more widely and that care is affordable across the spectrum of income and work situations in the population. One way you might want to do that is think about having insurers no longer have a disincentive to enroll sick people. Sick people obviously need care, and if insurers make more money when they enroll only healthy populations, they'll work very hard to manage their risk pools so that they avoid high-risk people, whether it's explicitly through changing the premiums or whether it's in a less obvious way by providing less generous benefits for expensive conditions, by providing worse customer service. You want to remove the incentive for insurers to avoid high-risk populations by ensuring that they're paid more for enrolling high-risk populations, but not having the high-risk populations themselves pay that extra premium. So there should be a subsidy that goes along with the health risks of the enrollees. And then insurers could compete to provide the highest value care, even to sick populations.
Well, I don't see the evidence that private insurance is more cost-effective than private systems in other countries, and they certainly have a much higher overhead in terms of administrative costs than Medicare does here. And when Medicare was instituted, most prescription drugs were administered while people were in the hospital, and they don't spend as much time in the hospital now as they do then, and we have a much greater usage of pharmaceuticals now than we did then. So times have changed, but I think, you know, we can make Medicare more flexible. I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is that we have a profit motive behind healthcare, which, you know, healthcare is not a commodity. It's not something that should be treated like a commodity. And until we stop thinking of it as a commodity and a privilege as opposed to a right, then I don't think we're ever going to really have universal care. Thank you.
All right. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that healthcare is not like other goods. We think people deserve at least a basic healthcare package, the same way that we think people deserve, you know, basic food and basic housing, and that as a society we've made what I think is a very good decision to say it's important that everybody should get access to these basic necessities of life, and I put healthcare in that category as well. The problem is that we live in a world of finite resources. We can't spend more than 100% of GDP on healthcare, and we should probably spend significantly less than 100% of GDP on healthcare. So there's a question of what benefit we want to ensure that everyone has access to. It can't be every possible item of healthcare that could improve their health, because that would be more than 100% of GDP, because we're blessed to live in a world in which medical advances have produced newer and better treatments that are very expensive. So we have to figure out how we can ensure that everyone has at least a minimum bundle in a way that maintains an incentive to develop new life-saving technologies. And I'm an economist. I can't help but think that profits aren't so bad. Profits drive innovation and drive, but that's why we've developed such path-breaking pharmaceuticals and treatments that other countries enjoy as well. If there were no profit in development of new technologies, I think the development would be substantially slowed. If you look at the growth of healthcare costs in the U.S., pharmaceutical company profits or insurer company profits are a very small share of total spending. Now, that's not to say that we're allocating resources efficiently or that the current system is working well. I certainly don't believe that. But taking the profit out of medicine, I don't think, is the answer.
Let me again introduce our guest as we're coming near to the midpoint here of this conversation. We are talking with Catherine Baker. Since 2007, she's been professor of health economics in the Department of Health Policy and Management in the School of Public Health at Harvard University. She also served between 2005 and 2007 on the Council of Economic Advisors, and that was focusing on health policy. She's also been on the faculty of University of California, Los Angeles, and at Dartmouth, and among other things, is involved with this committee that we've talked a little bit about. That's the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Health Insurance Status and Its Consequences. And in part, what we're doing here is talking a little bit about a recent report issued by the Institute of Medicine. This was, I believe, in February, basically outlining the fact that we do still have a serious problem with people in this country who are not insured, that that number continues to grow, that there are serious health consequences for those people. But for the community as a whole, even for people who have health insurance, there are consequences and reason to be concerned about those people who do not have health insurance. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Up next, someone in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hi, let's see, how to organize my thoughts. Lots of interesting things being discussed here. The most recent thing our guest just talked about was innovation and not wanting to squelch that. And I keep thinking to myself, well, it would be lovely to have a life-saving drug. My understanding of our current situation is we'd get a lot more bang for our buck if we spent our money dealing with obesity and lifestyle changes in terms of obesity and smoking and substance abuse. And you'd save a heck of a lot more lives than you would from some new wonder drug. But we as a culture seems to think that there's going to be some diet pill, something that's going to save our lungs if we've been abusing them all this time. We seem to work at trying to commit suicide and then expecting the medical medicine to save us from our self-destructive tendencies. So that's one thought. I really don't think we can hold out this idea that drugs and medical procedures are going to save us from ourselves if we want to get the most for our money. The other thing is that we often hear people talking about I don't want to have socialized medicine, but they'll accept Medicare. They don't want to have, they want to fight whatever thing it is that's killing them. And we spend most of our money, our huge chunks of our money on the last the year or even less of life, when what we might be wanting to do better is to say, be willing to say to people, it's really not worth fighting at this point. The cost is too much, and you're going to die anyway, and why not make the most of the time that you have left and be comfortable and make peace with your family, with whatever. So our dealings with death need to be changed. And I hear about how England, after being really devastated by World War II, managed a few years later to institute national health care. And if they can do it in such terrible circumstances, why can't we do it? And we would have to say some things we can't afford to do. And how do we get the American public to say, yes, it's important to fight the main things that cause us problems, and we can't do everything. There isn't a miracle for solving all of our medical problems. So that's a mouthful.
Well, yeah, the caller raises a number of very good, very large, very complex questions. And I don't know which of that is you'd like to try and take some of that on.
Those are really great points. And you mentioned at the top of the hour that I also serve on a Robert Wood Johnson Commission to Build a Healthier America that issued its findings just a few weeks ago. And the goal of that commission was to look at the non-healthcare factors that are so important in determining health outcomes and in disparities of health outcomes. Just the types of things the caller outlined, obesity, smoking, you know, nutrition and exercise, exposure to environmental toxins, all sorts of health behaviors are probably much more substantial inputs into our failure to achieve the health that we could as a nation than healthcare itself. By the time somebody shows up at the hospital with uncontrolled diabetes, it's already too late in some sense to achieve the health that that person could have achieved if the diabetes had never occurred or had been controlled all along. So the investment that we make in that kind of public health, improving access to healthy foods, increasing exercise, et cetera, probably achieves health at a much more cost-effective way than increasing health care does. So I would not want you to take from this that the only thing that we need to achieve great health for everyone is better health care. That's really important, but it's not sufficient, and it's probably not as cost-effective as some of those other interventions. Then on the flip side, if you look at the really intensive way that we spend healthcare resources, like in the end of life, as the caller mentioned, and Medicare spends pushing a third of its resources on care that Medicare beneficiaries receive in their last year or so of life, what do we get for really intensive spending? There's some great evidence out of the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare that's available online, and I spent 6 years at Dartmouth, so I learned a bit about this data when I was there. The variation in how much Medicare spends for each beneficiary across the country is astounding. It varies by a factor of 2 or 3. And these are people who all have the same insurance product, all people enrolled in traditional fee-for-service Medicare. And if you look at why we spend so much more per beneficiary, it's not that they start out sicker, and it's not that they get better health outcomes. It's not even that they're more satisfied with their care. It's just a much more intensive style of practicing medicine in some parts of the country than in others that does not seem associated with better health care, and in fact, if anything, seems negatively associated with value. Medicare beneficiaries in the parts of the country where we spend the most per beneficiary are the least likely to get flu shots, to have mammograms, for diabetics to have eye exams and blood level monitoring, that very minimally invasive, minimally intensive care that is extremely high value in terms of producing health. Now, that's probably not because we're spending money for the purpose of avoiding flu shots, but rather basic care may fall through the cracks when people are seeing a lot of specialists, are spending a lot of time in the ICU, and are having so many more of the resources in the area devoted to end-of-life care.
I want to thank the caller, and hope that you wouldn't mind if I go on, because I got some other people here who are in line, and I want to get them on. But her comments and your response and our general topic here suggest that there are all sorts of things that we could do to improve healthcare and the healthcare delivery system in this country. We started out talking about the fact there are a lot of people who don't have health insurance. And here now you've just given some examples about problems associated with having some kind of chronic health condition that just goes untreated. And then once you start to get in for treatment, it's almost a little too late. That is, you got serious problems, and you could have headed those things off if you could have gotten that person care earlier. We also have problems connected with unhealthy lifestyle, and we could do a lot with prevention. We also have the issue of the very high cost of care in a prescription medicine, and just delivering care is very expensive. We have all sorts of problems here, and I think sometimes it's the tendency to say, can we somehow do something to develop a system that will take care of all of these problems? I mean, is it really possible to have a kind of a comprehensive overhaul of American healthcare and address all of these things?
That's certainly the challenge. And it's tempting to start picking off easier to achieve or easier to think about goals and separating them out from the other goals. I don't think that's the best way to get really high value care that's universally available out of the system. There's a real tension in the policymaking process between covering the uninsured and controlling costs, for example, where some people think, you know, controlling costs is really complicated. We want high-value care. There are so many moving parts. We don't really know how to get it. We do know how to cover people. There are, you know, a menu of options available for getting universal coverage. There are lots of examples at the state level. At least that we know how to do. So let's address that and deal with costs later. I think that piecemeal approach is a little dangerous in that if you design a system to cover the uninsured that you can afford today and you don't do anything to address rising healthcare costs, you won't be able to afford to cover people tomorrow, so the system won't be sustainable. On the other hand, if you focus just on costs and don't focus on getting more people under the insurance umbrella, you risk having a real degeneration of risk pooling, having high-risk people not be able to afford insurance and delivering care to them ineffectively. So I think both goals are more achievable when they're addressed together, but that does involve a pretty sweeping set of reforms. And it's a real challenge for policymakers, especially, I think, when budgets are tight.
Well, that seems to be that's where we are now. And I think that some people would look back to the attempt to do health care reform that we saw in the Clinton administration, and they would say the lesson there is that sweeping, overwhelming change just is not possible. You might as well just forget it, because there are too many people who have reasons to resist that kind of change. And I think then what happened was that people in Washington said, all right, that we have no other change but to try to take the big problem apart into smaller pieces, do incremental change and say, well, okay, what can we do to try to improve health care for seniors? And then what can we try to do to make it possible for people who have young children to get their health care taken care of? And they would say that And here now we have an administration who once again is talking about doing something dramatic and comprehensive. I find myself wondering, is that really possible?
I think the piecemeal approach might be more feasible politically, although I'm sure I don't know. But the more comprehensive approach is likely to achieve better health outcomes for the money that we spend on it and more widely distributed better health outcomes. If I got to design the system myself, I'd want to address those concerns at the same time. I think another danger that you highlighted is because we're all so concerned about our own budgets, you know, how our families can afford health care, and then federal and state budgets, can we afford the public programs that we're trying to expand to cover more populations? There's an allure of cost-saving, value-improving innovation. I think people would love to both reduce costs and improve health by eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, and by, you know, getting better disease management that'll both save lives and save money. And while that's appealing, and I would love to do that to the extent possible, I think we have to realize that in truth, most of the things that improve health cost money, and most of the things that save money aren't particularly good for health. And there's some tough choices that we're going to have to make about how we ensure that everyone has at least a minimum package that we find accessible, acceptable, while at the same time designing programs that both individuals and federal and state government can afford. An example, going back to covering the uninsured, I think it's appealing to think if we just covered the uninsured, we'd save money because we'd be able to substitute more cost-effective primary care for really ineffective emergency department care that's both very expensive and not good for people's health. And that's true. When somebody shows up in the emergency room with asthma, an out-of-control asthma attack, it's very expensive to treat and it's not good for health. Whereas if the person had had better primary care to control asthma ahead of time, that person would have had better health and been less expensive to the system. But uninsured people on average consume too little care overall. That's not good for their health, but it's cheaper than the care they would consume if they were insured. So we should think about expanding coverage to the uninsured because it's really important for their health, not because it solves our federal fiscal problem.
All right. We have about 20 minutes left. Our lines are full. We'll get to get back to callers. Next up is Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. The previous caller mentioned the British system being installed post-war. Of course, Truman tried to institute it here. At that time, a majority of doctors were opposed, and the AMA pretty much torpedoed it. It was going to be included in the New Deal, too, but the fight wasn't was too broad already at that time. The point I'm trying to get at is that now doctors, the majority of doctors apparently are in favor of a single-payer insurance system that would leave their clinics in independent held, but in favor of of getting rid of that inefficiency that is the healthcare insurance industry. So, you know, we have a majority of doctors at least, and there's been a majority of, if you poll correctly and in an untendentious way, you find that a majority of Americans also support that. So the problem is we have a state capture phenomena where the health insurance industry, big pharma, are the people that call the tune in Washington. It's well documented. That part of the economic argument that I think needs to be made as well. I was just recently at a rally about single payer, and I met a bunch of interesting nurses. And one of their slogans is, "We don't want health care. We don't want health insurance. We want health care." They're just sick of it. They are really absolutely sick of it. And for you to say that Medicare was not innovative and didn't have any pharmaceutical aspect, it just belies the workings of this juggernaut of the big pharma and the health insurance industry. They didn't want it to have it, and the only way it got instituted was to not allow there to be any bargaining by the what would be the biggest buyer of these products. So I'm sorry, I think there's a comparable capture of academia and think tanks by the healthcare and big pharma. So I'll stop my jeremiad here.
Ralph, Professor Baker?
The caller raises some really interesting points. I agree that back in 1965, the AMA was actually opposed to Medicare because they were worried about federal takeover of the healthcare system. And that's why Medicare started primarily with hospital coverage and only then could add physician coverage and then 40 years later add pharmaceutical coverage. The fact that there is this real tension with stakeholder interests and what these big public programs cover, I think actually speaks to the point that it is very difficult to design a monolithic system that gets things right, that isn't subject to different interest groups, that isn't slow to evolve, that can write down a set of administered prices that actually induces efficient use of resources. And there are lots of inefficiencies in Medicare, as seen through that wild variation in both the cost and quality of care delivered through the Medicare system, that suggests that that monolithic system isn't at the frontier of getting high value. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that the private sector is at the frontier of getting high value either. I think both sectors could be improved. The question is, what mechanism do we think is the right way to allocate scarce resources? A couple of people have brought up the British system. other people look at the Canadian system, each of these systems, including the U.S. system, has a way of rationing care, implicitly or explicitly. And I think a lot of people bristle at the idea of rationing care, that that is just somehow wrong. But the fact of the matter is, when you live in a world of scarce resources or finite resources, care will always be rationed one way or another. I think we deem it unacceptable for it to be strictly on the ability to pay, where rich people get all the care they can consume and poor people get nothing. That seems completely wrong. We also, I think, are not comfortable with the idea of just waiting in line, where you wait 6, 9, 12 months for a hip replacement just based on availability of providers in an administered system. We also, I think, are uncomfortable with the idea of the government writing down a set of rules that decides who gets which procedure at what point. There must be some compromise, uniquely American way to allocate those resources, and I suspect that it would be having a minimum bundle of resources available for everyone, and then having people who can afford to get more free to do so. And systems that have tried to prevent the high-income populations from getting extra care have found that that system quickly unravels.
Well, I'm sure that the caller will not find that satisfying, but I just have about 10 minutes left, and again, I have other callers, and I'd like to get some more people in on the conversation. And also, for anybody who's just tuned in, introduce again our guest, Catherine Baker. She's professor of health economics in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's commissioner on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Commission to Build a Healthier America, and also serves on the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Health Insurance Status and Its Consequences. Next caller here in line is in Champaign, in line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm just going to be brief. I want to incorporate the comments the previous caller made, and one that goes back to the point that we cannot, and I beg to differ, we cannot get universal health care as long as we keep the private sector involved, and that would be pharmaceutical companies, that would be insurance companies, that would be to some degree doctors who are driven by self-profit. I want to say I went to school that long, and therefore I deserve a high six-figure income. I do believe that health care is a problem in this country, unlike all the other industrialized countries in the world, because we've made it a business. And I know an economist would say there are virtues in a business if it's cost-effective. But these stakeholders in the private sector, you can look at Medicare Advantage, you can look at the Medicare Part D, and all those things are there to protect the stakeholders, the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and for that reason it's pie in the sky to talk about universal health care unless we're willing to jettison these private profit motive business enterprises. Thank you.
Well, Professor Baker?
I certainly would not advocate the unfettered, unregulated market as the solution to any of our healthcare problems. As many callers have pointed out, healthcare is not like other goods, both because we feel differently about people's rights to care, but also because it's very difficult for individuals to know what the right amount of care for them is, what the right procedure for them to have is, without getting solid advice from their providers, from their physicians, and it's very hard to provide financial protection without some kind of insurance market that pools risk in a way that doesn't leave high-risk people out of the umbrella protection that insurance provides. Now, that said, I don't think that having these private actors involved in the system means we can't have universal coverage. I think that we need to provide social insurance to back up the private insurance that we provide, where social insurance redistributes resources to low-income populations, redistributes resources to high health risk or unhealthy populations. But that social insurance can work in the context of a private marketplace that then promotes innovation. I think that's the way to get high-value care that doesn't squelch the life-saving innovations that we all benefit from, but ensures that their benefits are spread more widely across the population than they are now.
All right. Next caller is in Normal. Line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I'll be quick and brief, and I'll hang up and listen to you on the other side. I disagree with innovation. We've seen too many times with what you said earlier that you need profits to encourage innovation. But too many times throughout history, we see corporations where they hoard their, look at the car companies. They've actually declined in quality. They lost fuel efficiency since, like, the 70s. Also, too, they use their profits to override consumer choice. Once again, I refer to the car companies ripping up the trolley lines in California. Consumers wanted those trolley lines, but they took their profits and power to get more power for themselves. My other issue is that, and then we look at the innovations that the financial markets have with credit default swaps. And I'll just, next, Nelson Lichtenstein, in his book, In State of the Union, he posited that in the 40s, corporate America had they looked at Europe in horror and fear, and they said, we cannot do that. We cannot let health insurance get here like that because of the unions. And they said, we want to hold health benefits over the heads of the unions to basically, essentially, waste time in negotiations. Because European unions, they never even had to waste time in bargaining over it. They could get really creative on their negotiations about workplace rules, and the American corps were like, we ain't having it. Third, I went to Haiti, caught tuberculosis. Came back, I didn't know it. I had it for like 2 years, and I had health insurance through Health Alliance, and I went to go to the doctor, and he refused to test me. And I'm like, Doc, I've been coughing blood for 2 years. This ain't right. He's like, well, you know, blah, blah. I just sit there and argue with the guy. And finally, I told him, like, dude, I went to Haiti. What's going on here? And he was like, oh, he went to – finally, at that point in time, he decided to test me. And then sure enough, he's like, well, yeah, you do. And then he wanted to test me for AIDS because I had a kind of TB that only HIV people have. You know, but I was like, I've been paying this crap for months and months and months. And now I was like, okay. And then also, too, I don't think reform is possible at all in this country as long as we have our empire. We've got soldiers in 120 countries. We got hordes of mercenaries that we're footing the bill to. And that's the thing with Europe. After the 40s, they lost their empire. You know, French Equatorial Africa or British India, it was gone. They no longer had those expenses. And then also, too, the excessive CEO salaries, once again, was that they got held south? He made $1 billion in 1 year. I mean, how about wage caps? You know,
I got to jump in because we're getting close on time, and the caller, you know, you raised so many different points, and I don't know how much of that the guest can really take on. And maybe those that really have to do, again, let's get us back to talking about healthcare.
That one of the interesting points the caller raised was the role of innovation in improving our health outcomes. And I'd like to distinguish between whether technology is worth it on average and whether we're using the new technologies in the most cost-effective and high-value way possible. If you think about the invention of a new technology like an MRI, surely we are all better off because an MRI exists relative to its not existing. But the MRI on the margin for the extra patients you use it on is not so worthwhile. Once a hospital invests in such a machine, they have an incentive to run it 24 hours a day. And so the very last person who gets an MRI is probably not getting a lot of health outcome from the extra test. So the question is, how can we develop a system that promotes the invention of new things like MRIs, but then creates incentives for them to be used in a high-value way? If you really want to think about whether technology that we've acquired recently is worth it or not, think about whether you would like to have 1960s medicine at 1960s prices or 2009's medicine at 2009 prices. Even though we all think that healthcare costs a lot more than it needs to because of the misuse of resources and the inefficient system that we have, I'd still much rather get treated in 2009 at 2009's cost than in 1960s costs.
We are just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. I think we got one more call and we just can't take. Obviously, this is a very complicated issue, and we've talked about all kinds of things. Is there some particular thought that you'd like to leave people with?
Sure. I think some really interesting things have come out from the calls. One of them is we really need to invest not just in health care, but in health. And a lot of the public health investments like reducing obesity, smoking, alcohol use, exposure to environmental toxins, all of those things are really cost-effective ways to promote health and to reduce health care disparities across the country. But then when you look at our health care system, we both need to address the rising health care costs and suboptimal value that we're getting out of the system, and the growing plight of the uninsured. And addressing those two things together, I think, is the most effective way to ensure that high-quality care is available to everyone.
And what do you think is likely to happen here now within the next, year or two in Washington as people continue to talk about how we go about doing these things?
Boy, I wish I knew.
Well, that's an honest and a fair response. I guess we can leave it at that. Our guest is Catherine Baker. She's professor of health economics in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. She also serves as commissioner on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Commission to Build a Healthier America and on the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Health Insurance Status and Its Consequences. And I expect that if people are interested in taking a look at that report that we started out talking about, they can go to the Institute website and they can see that.
Absolutely.
All right. Professor Baker, thanks very much.
It was my pleasure.